Today is Wednesday, January 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The European Union and all the different branches of the European Union, the European Council, the European Parliament, have all been very clear that this withdrawal agreement that took 24 months to agree to is not for renegotiation.
Also ahead, the Taliban says it has agreed with the U.S. to establish two technical teams to determine mechanisms for the withdrawal of all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. And President Trump calls on Americans to avoid travel to Venezuela as Maduro offers to hold talks with the opposition. It's all on today's VOA's International Edition. Well, British and EU negotiators expressed different views today on the state of Britain's exit from the EU after British lawmakers gave Prime Minister Theresa May what she called a mandate to seek changes to the country's withdrawal agreement. A series of votes in the British Parliament yesterday resulted in May's party getting approval for its plan to seek alternative arrangements to the Irish border provision of the current Brexit deal. British Brexit Minister Stephen Barclay told BBC Radio in an interview today that those changes would be the subject of negotiations in the coming days. But on the EU side, Chief Brexit Negotiator Michel Barnier said the bloc's position is very clear. Reporter Catherine Field is covering Brexit developments. She provides us with more insight.
The European Union and all the different branches of the European Union, the European Council, the European Parliament, have all been very clear that this withdrawal agreement that took 24 months to agree to is not for renegotiation. It has been agreed in outline in 2017, it was agreed in full in December 2018, and that it's not going to be renegotiated. We've had, for example, the European Council President, Donald Tusk, he has said quite clearly the withdrawal agreement is and remains the best and only way to ensure an orderly withdrawal. He said it is not open for renegotiation. The Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, has said that the EU needs to hold its nerve and not give in to the will of the centre-right or the far-right in the United Kingdom Parliament who want a change. So they're pretty much just saying, look, we came to this agreement. We're not going to renegotiate it. If you come back at some stage with some sort of reasoned request, yes, let's talk about it. But at this stage, they're just holding firm and saying, no, the problem is for the UK to deal with the problem.
And what is the expectation later on this evening? I know Theresa May, she is going to be meeting with the council.
Indeed. She'll be meeting with the European Council President, Donald Tusk. Now, he has already said, you know, no, there's no room for any change to the withdrawal agreement. So quite where that conversation will go is very difficult to see. But she is going to be talking to him, and they're going to be trying to find some sort of way out. But in lots of ways, they're both really at the end of an alley, because this withdrawal agreement that they spent 2 years negotiating needs to be backed by British Parliament for it to come into force. So the agreement will go nowhere. If Parliament doesn't approve it, it will be 2 years of nothing. So quite what they can discuss is going to be difficult to foresee. But make no mistake, the European Union is well aware that it has to stand firm. It's got European parliamentary elections coming up in May. There is this threat that the populist parties all around Europe, not just in France, but also in Italy, Poland, Hungary, and even in Bulgaria, that these populist movements who have been hitting up on the EU, saying the European Union isn't good for the country, they want to send a message that to them in particular, their own electorate, that the European Union is united, it's strong, and that by staying united as a bloc, then they are much stronger for being able to survive the winds that come with the trade disputes and also on the international stage for matters of diplomacy and security.
Also, business leaders looking at it from an economic standpoint, I understand they're worried that a no-deal Brexit would lead to economic chaos.
Indeed, the no-deal Brexit, which is just the United Kingdom leaving without a deal, would bring enormous chaos. Certainly, when you look at the figures, one-third of the fresh fruit and vegetables that gets eaten in the United Kingdom is imported from Europe. So that wouldn't be able to move across, because there would be no agreement for which this produce would move across. So you've got a problem in the United Kingdom because you're going to have shortages. You're also going to have businesses saying, well, if we don't know under what deals we'll be able to trade, then you know, we can't do anything. On the other side, you've got the European side who is saying, well, we need to trade with the United Kingdom, but now, because they're going to crash out, they're going to need to put up border installations. So if you go to somewhere like Calais on the northern French coast, you go there and you see the site now of customs booths being built and put in place, and there are customs officers being trained, because the whole basis of the European Union has been frictionless trade, no borders, no customs posts. And here we are seeing that the French are being forced, along with, say, the Netherlands, to put up these customs posts and to actually start thinking that come April, they're going to have to start checking every truck that goes in each direction across the English Channel.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Well, Taliban negotiators say the U.S. has agreed with the militant group to establish technical teams to determine mechanisms for the withdrawal of American and NATO troops from Afghanistan and for preventing terrorists from using Afghan soil against America and its allies. There was no immediate reaction from the Afghan government or U.S. officials to the assertions made by the Taliban chief negotiator. I spoke with reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad about what's known of the talks.
Well, what we know as of this moment is that for the first time, the chief negotiator from the Taliban, Sher Muhammad Abbas Sanakzai, gave an interview today to a pro-Taliban media outlet in which he revealed so many details about his negotiations with U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, that lasted 6 days in Doha, Qatar. And he basically asserted that 2 points that the two sides discussed in Qatar were just that the U.S. would withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, and the Taliban have given assurances that they will not allow anybody to use the Afghan soil for terrorist attacks against America or any of its allies. But the interesting points that he made in his interview were that the Taliban will not sit down with the Afghan government for any peace negotiations, because as long as there are foreign forces in the country, Taliban chief negotiator said that there's no reason for them to speak to the Afghan government. And he categorically rejected this administration of President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul as an illegitimate entity and something that has been in place because of the American pressure, military pressure. That shows that the sticking point that Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. envoy, has been pushing for, that there should be a direct dialogue between the Taliban and the Afghan government, is not going to take place. And Taliban is still practically saying that they just want the Americans to withdraw from Afghanistan before any political process takes root in Afghanistan.
What are the Afghan and U.S. officials? What is their reaction?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of concern and confusion among Afghan officials, including President Ghani, because whatever has happened over the past 1 week has been really a surprising development for the government in Kabul. And I think they were not prepared to deal with this kind of a situation. Maybe they were not expecting that the U.S. would make so much progress in the talks with the Taliban. And that is the point which Zalmay Khalilzad highlighted yesterday on Tuesday when he was giving an interview to a local Afghan television station in Kabul. And he acknowledged that while he has made progress in talks with the Taliban, there does not seem to be a consensus among Afghan government officials and leaders in Kabul. They don't know how to carry the peace process forward.
That was reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad. Among the top stories in the world, negotiators from China and the U.S. meet in Washington today to attempt to resolve an ongoing trade war. U.S. President Donald Trump defends his handling of the perilous world threats, but retreated from previous boast about the U.S. had defeated the Islamic State terrorist group. And South Korea's initial attempt at countermeasures to end the country's current fine dust problem failed this week. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The
U.S. Geological Survey says 71% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. A couple of recent studies have also suggested that there are oceans of water deep inside our planet's mantle. Scientists suggest after its formation about 4.53 billion years ago, Earth was a dry, hot, and molten planet. A heavy bombardment of water and ice-bearing asteroids and comets several million to a billion years later provided the supply of H2O we rely on today. Now, research by a team of geoscientists from Arizona State University proposes another source of Earth's water they say has been overlooked. The sun and planets were formed from a large cloud of gas and dust containing an abundant supply of hydrogen. The study suggests a combination of all that hydrogen, along with Earth's rocky materials, could be the origin of most of our planet's water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is willing to negotiate with his opponents to solve the political crisis in the South American nation. But U.S. President Donald Trump warned Americans not to travel to Venezuela until further notice. Trump's early morning tweet referred to Maduro's offer to hold talks with the country's opposition forces and hold early legislative elections. He added the threat of U.S. sanctions, including cutting off Venezuelan oil revenues, contributed to Maduro's apparent softening stance. Maduro said there will not be a new presidential election until 2025, rejecting a demand by opposition leader Juan Guaido, the president of the opposition-controlled National Assembly. Guaido declared himself the nation's interim president last week after the assembly declared Maduro's presidency as illegitimate. Guaido called on Venezuelans to mount a peaceful two-hour midday protest today to demand that the armed forces side with the people. He is offering amnesty to soldiers who back his movement and reject Maduro's socialist government. Well, the mass migration flows that followed the Arab Spring in North Africa and the Middle East were partly caused by climate change. According to new research, scientists from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria say that in certain circumstances, climate conditions can lead to conflict, which drives increased migration. Henry Ridgewell reports.
As the Arab Spring uprisings took hold across the Middle East and North Africa in 2010, millions of people fled their homes to find new lives in the years that followed. Researchers claim to have identified evidence of a causal link between those conflicts and changes to the climate across the region and the ensuing migration flows. The report authors, including Raya Mutarak of the University of East Anglia, say the roots of the Syrian conflict can be found in preceding droughts and water shortages. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
People started not being able to produce agriculture production, and that was the start of migration from the rural area to urban area, which was already quite crowded. And the resources in the urban area was also scarce. So when there was a kind of tension of fighting for limited resource, and on top is the ethnic polarization in Syria. So it's sort of all that combination.
The researchers used data on asylum applications and conflict-related deaths. They combined this into a mathematical model with data on drought and rainfall, plus other variables such as population size and measures of democracy and ethnic diversity. Again, Raya Mutarak.
So let's look how climate increases the probability of conflict. And once we estimate that, we use the number that we got from that to estimate the next step. So the country that experienced conflict from climate variation, are they likely to send out the refugee flows or not?
The researchers emphasize that climate change will not cause conflict and subsequent asylum-seeking flows in every instance.
The effect of climate on migration through conflict, it's quite specific to certain time period and to certain countries. So climate-induced conflict, it's a bit more likely in the country with the medium level of democracy.
The results of this study are specific to the Western Asia region and the time period in question. But it's hoped the research will contribute to the global debate on how migration flows will be affected by increasingly severe climate change. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
South Africa's coal mining heartland has the worst air quality in the world, according to a recent study by environmental group Greenpeace. The 12 large coal mines in this area make it the world's hotspot for toxic nitrogen dioxide emissions. Residents and health experts say the effects are ruining their health and their lives. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
35-year-old Patrick Mdluli considered himself healthy until he moved 2 years ago to Mpumalanga province, South Africa's coal mining heartland. He developed breathing problems, including tuberculosis and nasal issues.
The mines, the dust, pollution. You go to doctors, they tell you the very same thing. Are you living next to a mine? Yes, I am. Are you living next to a dumping site? Yes, I am.
A large coal mine operates, literally, in Mdluli's backyard. The mine has conducted blasts every day, shaking his small home to its foundation and causing a large crack in the wall. This sunny swath of South Africa last year earned the unfortunate distinction of having the world's worst air quality, says the environmental group Greenpeace. And it shows, says the head of one of Middelburg's main clinics, Dr. Mohamed Tayob. Tayob has lived in the area his entire life and says the emissions from the mines have made many of his patients sick.
Children and adults are paying the ultimate price. When we say ultimate price is the neurocognitive loss of neurocognitive development, children's infant mortality rate is higher in our area than other areas. Adults' heart attacks and respiratory disease are much higher. So people are paying with their lives across the board because of these pollutants in the air.
Tayo blames the coal mining industry and poor governance. Although mines are big money, locals say the coal companies have done little to improve the community. Middelburg is poor and many people lack basic services like electricity and running water. Tayob says the government is also failing to enforce environmental laws and crack down on the mines.
One cannot be faulted in thinking, is there some level of corruption operating in this area as well, where these big boys are getting away with murder, literally. They're literally getting away with murder. It's just the reality. I mean, I'd like somebody to come up and dispute this fact and challenge me on that.
VOA contacted three of the larger mines in the area for comment. None of them responded to our request. Environmental activist Bafana Hlatshwayo says he and other activists are preparing to lobby decision makers at an upcoming mining industry gathering in Cape Town. They want the coal industry to shift to a cleaner resource, the region's abundant sunshine. Bringing solar panel production to the area, says Hlatshwayo, would also create jobs.
We're not saying we want to close down the mines. We must go the renewable energy way. So when we talk about the energy renewable way, we are saying people will manufacture solar panels inside South Africa, and they are the ones who are supposed to install the solar panels, and they are the ones who are supposed to maintain the solar panels.
But that is a faraway dream for people like Mdluli and his neighbors, who complain unemployment is high and all of them, including the children, have health problems. This province, says longtime resident and environmental activist William Giane, used to be beautiful.
It's an endless agony now in Mpumalanga. It's not a bread and butter anymore. It's an endless agony.
South Africa is the continent's largest coal producer and relies on coal to power much of the economy. But for the poor communities that live in the shadow of coal mines, it just makes them sick. Anita Powell, VOA News, Middelburg, South Africa.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the West perpetually talks about its democratic values, self-determination, and freedoms. Can these concepts become realities in Africa? Discussing freedom of expression on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Need a little Straight Talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
According to one estimate, more than 70 million people in Nigeria use skin lightening products regularly, making Africa's most populous country the capital for skin bleaching. For women, some of them reject the trend, saying their natural dark skin is beautiful. But as Timothy Abiezu reports for VOA from Abuja, Nigeria remains a huge market for skin whitening products.
25-year-old Nigerian model and actress Goodness Ben visits a cosmetic shop in Abuja. She wants to be famous and says bleaching her skin could increase her chances at getting more movie roles.
Yes, this is Nigeria. A fair skin is business. That's what it's business. In movie industry, most times the director wants you to like glow. In fact, you should be camera friendly. You know, most times dark people tend to, will I say resist? I don't know. But they are more beautiful and they are catchy when they come in contact with the camera.
According to a 2011 estimate from the World Health Organization, 76 million Nigerians, mostly women, use skin lightening products regularly. Some darker-skinned Nigerians are pushing back against the idea that lighter is better. They say black is beautiful with the so-called melanin movement. Tina Ohanu says she doesn't need to bleach her skin.
My confidence really doesn't come from my skin. It comes from within. And I still get as much attention from the male folk as every other lady should. So I don't think it has anything to do with my confidence.
Bleaching products usually contain hydroquinone, corticosteroids or mercury as key ingredients. These chemicals could have a range of side effects when used regularly, according to skin experts.
You can have stretch marks, the skin becomes fragile, doesn't heal properly. Sometimes you can have, some of them can give you abnormal skin odor, abnormal odor, excessive sweating, poor wound healing too, and then it ages faster.
The beauty industry in Africa is worth several billion dollars and increases by 8 to 10% every year. Nigeria is one of the prime destinations for many beauty agents produced abroad. Ghana, Ivory Coast and Rwanda banned all whitening products while Nigeria joined South Africa in barring those with harmful chemicals. While these moves help promote natural and healthy skin tone, however, the melanin movement is still dwarfed by Africans' demand for skin lightening products. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Thank you, Timothy, for that report. In other news, two people are dead after a grenade attack on a mosque in the southern Philippines today, the second deadly attack on a religious site in the region after a landmark referendum approving an autonomous Muslim region. Police say four other people were injured in the early morning bombing in Zamboanga City, which was denounced as inhumane by the local Alama Council. Authorities say they do not believe it was in retaliation for Sunday's twin bombings of a Catholic cathedral on Jolo Island that left 21 people dead. The Islamic State terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the Jolo attack, but local authorities believe it was carried out by the militant Abu Sayyaf group. The group, which has pledged allegiance to Islamic State, has carried out hundreds of bombing attacks, kidnappings and beheadings in the region for decades. The successful January 21st referendum grants the Muslim-dominated southern Philippines autonomy in the predominantly Catholic nation. The referendum establishing the new Bangsamoro region was the result of negotiations between the government and Muslim separatists who have carried out a bloody decades-long rebellion. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
welcome to Upfront.